little nervous of starting the ethics presentation late, so we'll start a little earlier than we normally do. I want to thank Paul Lucy and Olivier Ryer for being our presenters this morning, and they've got a great topic. It's ethics, of course, but it's going to also intersect with technology and some new ethics rules related to that, so I know you're going to love it. Come back in January, again, not on our regular day. It's going to be on January 24th, it will be a Tuesday, but January 24th, and we're going to have Richard Grossnick and Lisa Yoon about IRS and U.S. attorney procedures. So anytime you have tax claims and you got to deal with Richard or Lisa, you're going to want to know what they're thinking and what the little tricks and tips are. So they're going to be here 8:30, January 24th. Thanks again for coming. Have some cookies. Happy holidays, everybody. In case I don't see you, take it away, Olivier and Paul.
Great. Well, thank you very much for coming. So we're going to talk about two sets of changes to the Supreme Court rules, one of which is about to become effective, and the other of which became effective on July 1 of this year. Olivier is going to start with, oh, and by the way, we're again, Paul Lucy and Olivier Ryher from Leverson, Lucy & Metz. So first we'll start with the what's coming. A lot of important stuff for you to be aware of, anticipate, and in some cases master as it becomes effective. My part's the easy part, mostly, as you'll see, less intimidating, I hope, less panic-inducing changes that have already come into effect. So even if you haven't heard about them, you're probably not in a great deal of trouble. Olivia?
So my first part concerns the incorporation of technology changes into the Supreme Court rules in our rules of ethics. Those will become effective January 1st. They follow the changes that were made to the model rules to account for the rise in use in technology as part of our business and in how we interact with clients and the courts. The original amendments to the model rules were made back in 2012 and 13. They were incorporated across the various states in different timelines. All comments used in this outline that I have are the Wisconsin-specific ones. Although the comments aren't the black letter of the law, the State Bar strongly suggests that you follow their guidance, because if there's something that matches the comment, that's kind of where the way they're going to go. Some of the changes are non-technology. We'll mention those briefly, but we thought that the technology changes are more interesting, so we'll concentrate on those. I encourage you to look at the changes and the rules completely so that you can see what else has changed. Some of the changes were made to the rules, but most of them were made to the comments. The State Bar thought that the rules did not need to be changed that much. It's kind of their interpretation and how they incorporate the new technologies that we all use, and that was more important. So again, this is an overview. It's not the exhaustive list. And as Paul said, the trust account changes already have taken place, and that was back in July. The first place where we start is the terminology, where everything is concerned with the definitions. Changes to the rules and the comments now recognize the use of electronic communication and the expansions of ways that clients and lawyers communicate with each other. For example, the first one is the definition of written or writing, and that denotes a tangible electronic record of a communication or representation, including handwriting, typewriting, printing, photography, and they removed the word email to now just say electronic communications. Texts will work, internet chats, group texts. I have a networking group that I work with, and the guys communicate with this group text app, but none of them show up in my actual text system in my phone. I know that they are text because there's been an error before, and they all popped up in my text box one day, and I had 500 messages, but the program somehow takes the text away and puts them into separate programs, and there's all sorts of issues as to preservation later on that we'll touch base on. Another example of the changes to the definition is the comment number 9, which now replaces the word materials for a broader information in a screening Chinese wall context. So it talks about the purpose of a screening and how a lawyer that is screened should avoid any communication and any contact with, and it used to say files or materials, and now that's been removed, and it says information, including information in electronic form, and discusses the importance of the denial of access by the screened lawyer, and it used to say to the files or materials, but now also that electronic information. It recognizes the importance of accounting for access to files that are on your computers. At our office, we use kind of a cloud server where everyone can use some of the already used materials. You know, you have examples. That's where we store our files and our client files. But how do you prevent a screened lawyer, if that were to happen, to access a cloud server? I mean, I don't necessarily know the specifics of how to do that. I was talking to Mark about what they used to do at Reinhart. What was it like at Michael Best to... there's their screen room. You know, Mark was talking about the file room, and some of them, when there was a screen lawyer, the file would be removed and placed into the managing attorney's office under lock and key so that the lawyer couldn't access it. I don't know if...
Well, you're asking a digital question of an analog guy. I mean,
I'm talking about the analog method.
The analog method is, you know, you put all the relevant files are marked, mm-hmm. you know, that Paul Lucy should not have access to this file. In some cases, you'd have those files kept in a separate room, say a paralegal who's working on the matter, who's not working with Lucy. I know that there is an electronic counterpart to that.
Right.
But I haven't a clue.
But that's exactly what I'm saying, is if you're using, you know, some of these technologies, and a lot, we're raising a lot of questions today, and we don't always have the answer, but there are important things to think about. The ones we use at our office, we, you know, somehow have to create some kind of password-protected file folders or a separate server that, you know, could serve as a kind of a, you know, denial of access walled server, but some of the things to think about. Then there's the rule of competence. So the general rule is just that a lawyer has to provide competent legal representation to his or her client, and that requires the legal skill, knowledge, thoroughness, and preparation reasonably necessary for the representation. So now the comment that's been added acknowledges that a lawyer has a duty to keep abreast of technological changes. Comment number 6 was renumbered and put in as number 8, and it now reads that to maintain the requisite knowledge, skill, a lawyer should keep abreast of changes in the law and its practice, including the benefit and risks associated with relevant technology. So it's kind of specific. It's asking you to make sure that you're aware of what can happen, what are the risks, and what are the benefits of using electronic information. And you'll see with our factual scenarios later, you know, we'll try to bring up some of these issues. But it's important to know that you are expected to have a certain baseline level of competence with regards to technology as well. There are a couple of non-technology related changes in a rule to competence. I just mentioned them briefly. Take a look at comments 6 and 7.
I had a scenario recently that really was scary, at where a lawyer is not one of our regulars, but he was somebody that had, you know, practiced some bankruptcy work. He somehow went to a new email address, and his IT guy assured him that he didn't have to change his email address with the court, that he would set him up so that his address with the court would be automatically forwarded to the new email address. I mean, it sounds like, you know, that should work. Well, it didn't work. And he wasn't getting notices. And he wasn't getting notices that said, come to a hearing and explain to me whether your fees should be reduced. He doesn't come to the hearing. I mean, by the time he finally figured it out, somebody finally snail-mailed him something, and he was freaking out, but he assured me that he wasn't trying to disrespect the court. He just trusted his IT guy to tell him that all his emails would be forwarded, and they weren't. So I don't mean to say anything except to, it's very easy. You can change your own email address in your CM account. You don't need an IT guy to help you do that. I mean, the smart thing for this guy to do would have been to add both email addresses. There's nothing wrong with that. Lots of attorneys have more than one, or have one go to their assistant or their paralegal or whatever. So if you're getting a new email account, or you're changing firms or whatever you're doing, you want to be sure that those notices from the CM system are coming to you. And if you're not getting them, you better look into it and make sure that the technology is working for you.
And by the way, same thing goes for the new e-filing in state courts. You know, go to your wicourts.gov account and check your emails, because I discovered in a case now that had e-filing as of the first of this month, that I wasn't getting confirmation of something I had e-filed, discovered that my courts account had my old firm email and not the new one. You can have two email accounts in the state court electronic system.
And that goes to the technology competence issue. You know, you should understand how can you test your system to make sure once you've made these changes that you can get it and that you're making sure that you've received your information. The next rule that has some changes relates to the client communication. That rule governs how and when a lawyer should communicate with his or her client regarding the representation. Comment four to the rule was changed, and it took away the emphasis of the telephone as being the dominant means of communication. So they crossed out, if you see towards the end of the paragraph, it used to say client telephone calls should be promptly returned or acknowledged, and now it just says a lawyer should promptly respond to or acknowledge to client communications. Email probably dwarfs telephone use in most of our practices, or at least it's gotten to the point where it's 50-50, you know, your time and your communication with your clients. So the rule now acknowledged that telephone is no longer the king. We then have the confidentiality rule. That's the one that directs lawyers to keep their client's information confidential except under limited circumstances, which are usually discussed later on. There was a change to the actual rule to allow a lawyer to reveal limited information to detect and resolve conflict of interest. So 1.6C was added. Number six, the first part in item C lists all of the times where a lawyer should be allowed to disclose the information. And then number six that was added, it says to detect and resolve conflict of interest, but only if the revealed information would not compromise the attorney-client privilege or otherwise prejudice the client. The Wisconsin committee provided a comment that's contained in the actual statute. And this one, they point out that their rule here, C6, is not like the model rule, and it's broader than just trying to detect or resolve conflict of interest arising from a change of employment. It kind of takes into account when lawyers could pair up on complicated matters, and it takes into account that it's not just the merger or the change of employment that can be done. Paragraph 13, the comment 13 was added, and it kind of states when you are permitted to do it. It talks about being able to do it once substantive discussion regarding a new relationship have already occurred. So once you're pretty set on making this happen, and it says that no more than the identities and summary of legal issues should be shared in those cases. 1.6D is another technology-related one, and this one now says that a lawyer shall make reasonable efforts to prevent the inadvertent or unauthorized disclosure of or unauthorized access to information relating to the representation of a client. That's especially important in the electronic context. We'll discuss later that you should probably be aware of Russian hackers and Australian dissidents and be careful in maintaining your electronic information as well. The comment 18 that was added comes from this new rule in D. And it talks about what you have to do to act competently to safeguard electronic information against unauthorized access by third parties or inadvertent disclosure, which is the dreaded reply all. We should all be very careful in using reply all. And also the automated name filling that the program's Outlooks often do. I know my wife received a few emails from some Foley lawyer that lives in our neighborhood because she probably has the same, you know, first three letters of a name. So it talks about in Rule 18 the factors that are considered in determining the reasonableness of the security measure, the sensitivity of the information, the likelihood of disclosure if you're not using additional safeguards, the cost of employing those safeguards, the difficulty, and the extent to which they affect a lawyer's ability to practice. A lot of the changes related to this have to do with IP and patent law. And if you're working on very new technology for big companies, they probably expect you to have the measures in place. You know, big firms will have all of these. I know you were talking about Michael Best has a lot of measures already in place to deal with this kind of stuff. Small town lawyer with a small practice, you know, it went in our bankruptcy context, probably not as applicable, but there could be some information, you know, just related to the disclosure of somebody you've consulted with that needs to be kept away from public eye. Sometimes some of our clients, you know, do a lot of deals, and if they're caught wind of meeting with a bankruptcy lawyer, it could affect their refinancing or their ability to get loans. So things to keep in mind when you're storing your information in the cloud. 1.8 was also changed. That talks about the prohibited transactions. That one just acknowledges that Wisconsin has slightly different rules than the model rules, and they clarified what is a prohibited transaction in certain circumstances. And it has to do with the fact that the model rules do not prohibit a lawyer from essentially being, you know, working on a document and maybe participating in it, you know, in the trust and estates context, and the rules made it clear that Wisconsin does not allow that. 1.18 talks about the duties to prospective clients. So that tries to incorporate technological changes, emails, you know, referral websites and all that into when does somebody become a client. The rule was amended to include the word consults instead of discussing. That's actually defined in 1.0b. The discussions that I read mentioned the fact that they don't consider it the definitive decision, so that in this context, consultant, not just if you read B, it says, consult denotes the communication of information reasonably sufficient to permit the client to appreciate the significance of the matter in question. And some of the comments from the Supreme Court when they adopted the rule said that it's not just that definition, but should keep in mind that definition. 1.18b was amended to learn the information from the prospective client, and it talks about the specific information not being used. The comment number 2 was added to try to explain this. So the comment now provides that a person consulting with a lawyer about the mere possibility of a lawyer-client relationship is considered a prospective client. A consultation will occur if the lawyer requests or invites submission of information but fails to notify the client of the restrictions, again, creating that relationship. So if you're getting referrals from websites or your own website, it's probably important to have a disclaimer on there and use the disclaimer saying that it's not.
So, Olivia, if you at your website, if you have not only general public information, you know, this is the area of law that we concentrate on, but you have examples of clients you have helped. Maybe you don't disclose the clients, but situations where you've helped a client. And you also have a sort of a general banner that says, you know, how can we help you in your credit situation? And then you've got a link so that there's the possibility of email communication with the firm. Have you invited, in the language of the comment, have you invited someone from the public to disclose to you information that would create this prospective client relationship?
It would be a good idea to have the disclaimers related to the contact at a bare minimum. But it does say the last sentence, if you take a look at that comment, it's the highlighted, underlined sentence, I'm sorry. It says, moreover, a person who communicates with a lawyer for the purpose of disqualifying a lawyer is not a prospective client. Now, it's a little bit more than what you were saying. But it does acknowledge that just the communication is not necessarily creating the lawyer-client relationship. They talked about in the Supreme Court rules analysis that it's to account for taint shopping. It's still possible in this case, if somebody's going to meet with someone, you're still disqualifying, but just communicating is not sufficient. But in terms of your own website, you probably should have a disclaimer that no relationship is created just for the mere communication.
Yeah, and I don't know how you prove that someone is trying to disqualify you. What their intent is. Right. If that person has in fact responded to an invitation to, you know, give me enough information to determine whether I can help you, and there's, you know, I think. Absent some, you know, very strong facts in the lawyer's favor, it's going to be very difficult not to be held to the standard of a prospective dealings with a prospective client. regardless of what, you know, in the heart of hearts of that person, he or she was trying to do.
The comments in the rules, I think, tries to account for a very low effort in disqualifying a lawyer. They were just worried that merely sending an email could be used by others to disqualify you, and they just wanted to make it clear that an email, just a simple email, is not sufficient. So, of course, if there's a meeting, if there's information shared, then it's definitely more complicated, but just a simple email is not sufficient. The next rule that changed is 4.4. And that is an attempt by the Rules Committee to cover what is known as metadata. I assume everybody knows, but if you don't know, that's the data that's hidden in a electronic document. I don't really know how to get to it, but I know that it's always there. So things like a Word document, Excel, and probably another litany of programs that I'm not aware of, but in Word, which is one of the ones we use a lot, when you use track changes, you're able to see what you've changed and what you've accepted or rejected as changes, but that information is always there even if you don't turn on the track changes, so that if you were to send someone a Word document, there is a way to get the information to check and see how has everything changed, what did the other versions look like, a period was added, a paragraph was removed. So the rules here were amended to talk about a lawyer who receives a document or electronically stored information, and that's kind of the metadata or other if it ever changes in the future, relating to the representation of a lawyer's client and knows or reasonably should know that the document or electronically stored information was inadvertently sent, shall promptly notify the sender. Now, Wisconsin went one step forward and laid out what you need to do if you do receive such information. But in that rule, it specifically relates to lawyer-client privilege or work product rule. So when a lawyer was exchanging the client, the Word document goes back and forth with edits, and it tries to make it clear that if you ever see that kind of information, then it lays out what needs to be done. You should promptly cease reading the information. You have to notify the other lawyer that you've received important metadata, and then you have to abide by their instructions. The Wisconsin committee tried to clarify paragraph C because it's not like the model rule, and they try to incorporate that information. We'll talk about it a little bit more. We have quite a few fact scenarios that try to go through the metadata issue.
There's a, I should point out, there is an ethics opinion that says it is a lawyer may look for metadata in documents delivered by an adverse party.
Yes.
So it's kind of an interesting paradox. You are free to look for it. Now if you discover it and determine that it is was inadvertently sent to you, you know, what exactly have you gained? It may be that there are circumstances where that you believe that metadata is discloses something that that you ought to be able to use in litigation, and you may have to go to court and try to get a determination as to why that's so.
Mm-hmm. The next rule regards the non-lawyer assistants. What work can be outsourced as part of your practice? We were trying to discuss this a little bit before. A lot of these technology changes are pretty important, and as Judge Kelly mentioned, you know, hiring an IT guy, if you don't have one, you know, you're not a big office, you're going to have to outsource that kind of work. And what are the requirements? You know, what are the competency issues that arise out of that? Comment one and two, they acknowledge that you're allowed to use outside help. And then comment three was added. And in this case, the ethical obligation of the lawyer on the use of non-lawyers will depend on the education, the experience, and reputation of the non-lawyer, the nature of the services involved, the terms of any arrangement concerning the protection of the client information, and the legal and ethical environments of the jurisdictions in which the services will be performed, especially as it concerns confidentiality. So we were kind of trying to figure out what do the rules mean by that? Are they trying to account for regional differences? I mean, it's probably easy to get an IT firm in Milwaukee or Chicago that's competent, but what if you're, you know, in a smaller town, 5,000 people, 2,000 people, 2 hours away? Maybe there's a tech firm, and maybe the tech firm isn't as strong as the one that might be located in Milwaukee, or it's a young guy who, you know, taught himself computers and is pretty good at it. He can do it. He can set up the systems, but what are his understanding of security measures? So some of the things to think about. Then 5.8 talks about the responsibilities regarding law-related services. This is a new rule. Although the the law is not itself new. I mean, it talks about the bundling of legal services, especially in small towns, so title services, maybe realtor services, and how to keep those services separate so that the rules of professional conduct don't apply. The main one is to make sure that to comply with the rules, you should probably use a separate entity, because if you're not using a separate entity and a separate office space, then all of the services that you're provided will be subject to the rules of professional organization. So the next rule is advertising, and how has advertising changed with all of these technology changes? So the rule in general, 7.1 says communications, so lawyers can't make false or misleading communications about the lawyer's services, and it says how a communication can be misleading. And then advertising talks about a lawyer's ability to advertise to the public, but you can't give anything of value for any recommendations. Comment number two was added. You know, it provides that you can, acknowledges that email and website dissemination is fine. Comment number three was also amended to eliminate the language listing TV as the most powerful media, and instead now incorporates television, the internet, and other forms of electronic communication are amongst the most powerful media for getting information to the public. Comment five was also amended. It clarifies that a communication contains a recommendation if it endorses or vouches for the lawyer's credentials, abilities, competence, characters, or other professional qualities. And the comment five also acknowledges that a lawyer may pay other parties for generating client leads, specifically internet-based client leads, as long as the lead generator does not recommend the lawyer and the payments and communications with the lead generator are consistent with the fee-sharing rule and other rules contained in the code. Then we move to the solicitation of clients. That one was changed. The name of the rule changed from direct contact with prospective clients to solicitation. It removed the language from a prospective client from the rule, clarifying that the solicitation could apply in any circumstances. Comment number three was amended to say that communication by email or electronic means that do not involve real-time contact and do not violate the other rules are okay. So emails are probably fine, but text messages, as we'll see later on, are problematic and should probably be avoided. Comment one talks about what is a solicitation. That's a targeted communication initiated by the lawyer, directed to a specific person, and that offers or can be reasonably understood to provide legal services. So depending on how the emails are drafted and how they're done, can become a problem. Communication is not a solicitation, and there it accounts for the fact that it's directed at the general public. So internet banner ads, that's not going to be a solicitation. Or automatically generated internet search response, which is what they call search optimization. You know, who comes up first when you look for bankruptcy in Milwaukee, and paying for those services are not going to be an issue. And then we have the trust account rules that Paul would discuss briefly.
Sure. And I'm not following too closely the short outline that you've got, but so generally the trust account rule 21.15 was amended substantially in effective July 1 of 2016. Some of these changes are more formal than substantive. For example, recall that when the provisions regarding advanced fees and flat fees formulated in part, thank you very much, Len Leverson, by folks on Biker to accommodate bankruptcy practice, debtor practice. These provisions really were not trust account provisions. They were fee provisions, and now they have been moved with minimum changes to Rule 1.5, the fees rule of the Supreme Court rules. I'm not going to talk about that. One of the other changes made in as of July 1 was that what had been 1.15F, which was a long section on the specifics of trust account record keeping, those specifics are now no longer part of the rule. Those specifics have, in fact, become part of guidelines that are maintained by OLR and that you can find on the OLR website. And now the rule is, as I'll get to in a minute, is actually very generalized. Third thing that happened, also in connection with record keeping, OLR will now, in disciplinary proceedings against lawyers involving trust fund issues, either record keeping or conversion of trust property, OLR will have a rebuttable presumption with respect to that claim or that prosecution if lawyers don't keep their records properly and or aren't able to promptly provide accounting and other things. We'll talk about that. And then finally, there are provisions, provisions introduced a few years ago to permit e-banking. That is to say, clients being able to pay fees by means of credit cards and PayPal and so on, debit cards. Those have been tweaked, but also a new alternate form of e-banking is available to practitioners who don't want to go through the old, rather expensive and cumbersome process. All right, first, with respect to record keeping. So now there is, as I said, not in rule, it was rule 20.1.15F. Now we're talking about rule 20.15G. That is the section now called record keeping. I'm sorry, now that pertains to the record keeping for trust accounts. If you go to wicourts.gov and look for the OLR page, you will now find documents there, or links to documents, that are the OLR guidelines for trust account records and OLR guidelines for fiduciary account records. They're substantially what used to be 1.15F. And don't worry, if you have no interest in e-banking, you don't need to. This is not an issue of competence. You don't have to learn that in order not to, to be a competent lawyer. You can continue to do it with paper checks, and as you've done, as long as you're in substantial compliance with the guidelines. What's good about these removing the specifics from the rule? There are a couple of things. First of all, there's record keeping software that is competent software. I've not used it. I know that QuickBooks has a version. Trust account software, there are several others, that produce an output that didn't comply in every particular with former the requirements that were formerly in the rule. Now you don't have to. If you substantially comply with the requirements of the rule, which I'll read to you in a moment, you're good to go, and you can use that software, which many people find to be helpful. Secondly, now as practices change, as e-banking changes, OLR can amend these guidelines and give more pertinent guidance without going through the process of a Supreme Court order and rule change procedure. Yeah, so let me read to you what the new requirement for trust account record keeping is. It's 1.15G1. A lawyer shall maintain and preserve complete records of trust accounts, all deposits and disbursements, and other trust property, and shall preserve those records for at least 6 years after the date of termination of the representation. None of that's new. Electronic records shall be backed up by appropriate storage device, and the Office of Lawyer Regulation shall publish guidelines for trust account record keeping. That's it. this new section also makes clear that trust account records and the ability to account for your property held in trust is a matter of public concern and is absolutely pertinent to the OLR's job in regulating and, when necessary, disciplining lawyers. And so there's an obligation to keep those records available. The second, third thing that I was talking about that this change did is it created this rebuttable presumption, actually a couple of rebuttable presumptions, and I'm going to read that too. It's G sub 3. A lawyer's failure to promptly deliver trust property to a client or third party entitled to that trust property, to promptly submit trust account records to the OLR, or promptly provide an accounting of trust property to the to OLR, shall result in a presumption that the lawyer has failed to hold trust property in trust. So failure to promptly deliver, failure to promptly account for, failure to provide OLR with account records, all lead to this rebuttable presumption that you have not held trust property in trust. The presumption has to be rebutted by, and may be rebutted, by providing clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence. So that's kind of the flip side of the flexibility that that turning the former rule into guidelines entails. Okay, so now we also have what was the trust account record keeping provision is now in fact security, that is to say 1.15F is security requirements and restricted transactions. As I mentioned earlier, it's been possible to use e-banking before these changes of July 1. What you had to do is to create a second trust account, an e-banking trust account. And that essentially that account was really used as a method of getting funds in and out of your regular old-fashioned IOLTA account. And so you had to have two accounts, you had to have more accounting, more record keeping, and so on. That's still possible to do. And in some respects, you know, for folks who do a lot of this, may be the way to go. but there is now at 1.15F3C an alternative for those who don't have that kind of volume of e-banking and or for whom it doesn't make sense to have the cost and inconvenience of a second e-banking trust account. You can use your existing trust account and electronically receive or disperse assets of that account, provided you follow the new rules set forth. These are essentially this to use commercially reasonable security measures, whatever those are, number one. Number two, to purchase a bond or insurance, and I think it's equivalent to the highest balance of the prior year. It's in the rule. A bond or insurance to cover any losses to your trust account resulting from these transactions. And then three, to the extent you have chargebacks or merchant banking fees charged to your trust account, you have to promptly reimburse from your business account, reimburse the trust account for those charges from your business account. Another thing that is another e-banking provision that is now expressly permitted, it's not really e-banking, it's remote deposits. That is, you know, the thing you see on the TV commercial, being able to take a picture, an electronic image of a check, and deposit it in that fashion as opposed to go and present the check to a teller. That's now permitted. That doesn't require you to create an e-banking trust account or anything of the kind. What remains true is that telephone and ATM withdrawals from your trust account remain prohibited. So what are commercially reasonable security measures? Again, there's no definition of that pertaining to trust accounting, as there's no definition of that pertaining to protection of client data. at least with respect to trust accounting, the recommendation that OLR is giving is to, you know, to deal with your IOLTA participating bank, where you maintain your trust account. As those of us who have sometimes represented banks know, banks are generally well ahead of the legal profession in terms of these security measures. And so you may be able to find very helpful recommendations for keeping any your trust account secure from your banker. So that's all I want to do on the trust account changes. And now I think we're going to talk about some hypotheticals and invite your participation. And I think
I even have some bribes until they run out.
We've incentivized. We're going to incentivize your participation. Go ahead.
So the first one is we'll set the scene. Our lawyer has been practicing law for 45 years in a small town. Although his practice is not active as it used to be, he still litigates cases. Our lawyer refuses to use emails and computers because he doesn't think it's worth it to learn all this new technology at this point in his career. So is the lawyer complying with the rules of professional conduct? Yes, no to start. Anyone? They're delicious cherry candy canes. Okay. Probably not. Now, there's a caveat, but it has to do with the competence that we discussed before and the changes in what lawyers have to keep abreast of technology and understanding the risks and benefits. There is a decision out in California that's formal opinion 2015-193, and I'll read some of the passages from it. It says, not every litigated case involves e-discovery, yet in today's technological world, almost every litigation matter potentially does. The chances are significant that a party or a witness has used email or other electronic information digitally and has other forms of electronic information related to the dispute. If e-discovery will probably be sought, the duty of competence requires an attorney to assess his or her own e-discovery skills and resources as part of the attorney's duty to provide the client with competent representation. If an attorney lacks such skills and or resources, the attorney must try to acquire sufficient learning and skill or associate or consult with someone with expertise to assist. It is possible then for a lawyer to contract out e-discovery, but the lawyer still needs to be able to assess, you know, am I doing a wide enough search? Am I looking for the right things? And how are you looking at it? And if you've never used email and you're not using it, it's probably very difficult to even kind of understand how some of these functions work. There's no cases in Wisconsin yet about people not understanding technology. The only case there is about an e-filing failure that was mandatory. And now that the state is also going to mandatory e-filing slowly, I can't remember when all of the counties, I know some of them are mandatory now and everybody's moving towards it. So our lawyer probably will have to get with the time if he wants to continue practicing at least litigation. So now our lawyer discovers that computers are fun. He gets a few for his firm and his home. Although he's now comfortable with the use of email, he's still not the most tech-savvy practitioner. Recently, one of his large landlord clients sent him answers to discovery requests in Excel and Word format. The lawyer sends that electronic information to plaintiff's counsel. Did the lawyer violate the rules of professional conduct? Anybody want some candy? No. It's too early, huh? I know.
This is like taking candy from a baby here.
I'm giving it away. So again, what's competence in that situation? What I'm trying to get at with that fact pattern is the metadata. If you're just forwarding information on that you've received from your client, you're exposing your client here. Is there any metadata? I don't know. And this time it's coming from the client. The rules in Wisconsin seem to concentrate on work product and confidential information between the lawyer and the client. But in this case, I made it specifically so it's coming directly from the client himself. So, you know, what could be on there was only created by the client. It's not the same situation. It doesn't invoke the work product rule. But there is a rule in Wisconsin, an ethics opinion, which is EF-1201. And it talks about Paul said before, the disclosure of metadata. And it says that a lawyer who receives an electronic document is not prohibited from searching. Now, in this case, you've received it from the client, so you don't necessarily know. So as Paul said, you're allowed to take a look. And if none of the information relates to work product or confidentiality, it's likely that you are authorized to use it. It may come to a head and the other lawyer may try to prevent it, but you can use it. Go ahead.
Correct me if I'm wrong. isn't the most step one in avoiding this problem of inadvertently giving an adverse party all the changes you contemplated making, et cetera, to a document or revisions to the document, isn't it simply to use the function of turning the Word or Excel document into a PDF? Does that do it?
I believe that does it. That's the understanding that I have, but I am not a tech guy. Do you have? We have a tech guy in the room.
It depends on the settings. When it comes to Word, if you're saving a certain way, or it's like a PDF or PDF reader, it may eliminate some of the metadata that's encompassed in the Word document.
Sure.
There are some definite settings that you want to do as a first step that will clean that out to absolutely guarantee there will be no time metadata. And when older versions, like Word 2007, 2010, it was there, but it wasn't as prevalent. So if you're getting an older version of that file, you definitely want to explicitly check things out because it may or may not be turned on, it may miss something going forward. In the later versions, like Word 2016, if I remember correctly, I believe it is actually a process that by transitioning a Word document into a PDF, it does alleviate get rid of the metadata in here because it's basically taking a snapshot of what you're seeing on the screen and turning it into your PDF, your
photo,
readable document. As an FYI, you also can do and remove metadata from within your Adobe and PDF documents. I don't know about other PDF readers, but Adobe, because you have the ability to edit information, also holds metadata. There are explicit areas in preferences or editing menu bars that will allow you to make sure that you're removing metadata, removing the PDF, because if you go in and the common structs of file highlighted things, that kind of speaks to the same issue. And that's another place that you can look for, do a Google search online, be able to find out easy ways to remove metadata from Word document, from also PDF, because if you create a PDF in a Word document, that's great. If you want to do some highlighting or some editing in a PDF document, you got to square one. You put metadata again, showing the changes that you dealt with.
So I'm going to summarize in case anyone at the remote locations did not hear that answer from an IT expert. I'm wrong. You have to figure out what version of Word you have and what version of Adobe you have. What kind of PDF did Word create? And what kind of reader you're going to use in looking at that document. So it is not a simple matter of just turning your Word document, regardless of the version of Word you have, into any old PDF and thinking that all the metadata is gone. Isn't so. So important to do some research on this topic, if nothing else.
Mm-hmm. And it is, oh, yes, question.
But if you printed it and you scanned into a PDF document, have any.
Yeah. Correct. Yeah. I believe that's correct. If you print and rescan, that eliminates all of the electronic information because you're just getting a photo of what was on the scanner.
You don't need to know as much.
Nope, right. You don't need to know as much. That is a great way to wash your documents, if you call it that way. And it, the ethics decision talks about, essentially, if you receive anything of material significance, you should assume that you have to notify the other side because of the importance of it. They basically assume that you didn't want that revealed, even if it's coming from your client. Now, if it's not work product or confidentiality, you just have to notify them. It doesn't tell you what you have to do with it. But on the flip side, are you required to search for metadata in your competent representation? And that decision said no, because it assumes that lawyers are competent, so that they're complying with Rule 1.1, so that they're looking out for metadata and removing it before sending it to you, and confidentiality. So essentially the Supreme Court said you're allowed to search and when you receive it, but you're not required to because your opposing party is assumed to be competent and compliant with the rules. So given our lawyer's small-town practice, he's very judicious in keeping his overhead low. Our lawyer had his son-in-law, a wedding photographer by trade, who has a solid understanding of computers, set up his firm's computer and Wi-Fi system. Does this comply with the applicable rules? Well, some of the issues would have to be, I'm trying to get at the use of non-lawyer people involved in your firm, and what kind of background does the son-in-law have in computers? What is his competence in computers? Reasonable efforts have to be made to ensure that third party's conduct is compatible with the professional obligations of the lawyer. So I was trying to get at the comment here, that, you know, the number 3 in 5.3 that talks about the legal and ethical environments of the jurisdiction in which the services are performed. As we said before, if you're in a small town, there may not be some fancy tech firm, and the tech firm that is there, you know, may be of varying grades of professionality and what that goes with. So, yes?
Quick question on that. Do you think it would be advisable for the attorney to have a contract with that third-party service provider regarding these standards of the FTC?
Yes. Right. Mott mentions that it would be important to have a contract with the firm if you're contracting out with regards to all of the safeguarding of the information, probably spelling out some of the standards and mentioning that the firm is performing these standards and performing these services up to the standard. Some of the issues that I wanted to bring up with a Wi-Fi system, you know, what kind of Wi-Fi password is being used? Is it a commercially reasonable password? As we found out in our hacks, 123456 is not commercially reasonable password. You should probably think of one.
Password and okay password?
Probably not also. And they sell, if you're ever interested, there are devices, it's a little bit complicated, but there are devices that can be bought that generate passwords every day and are essentially kept, you know, it's kind of a physical box, and those allow you to reset your password every day. Some of the, you know, some of these things that are a little bit less complicated. I mean, in our practice, like I said, IP lawyers, you know, some of the more data sensitive practices probably have to worry about this a lot more than we do. We have to make sure that we protect our clients' financial information. You know, it's not as applicable to bankruptcy lawyer, but it talks about 1.6D now talks about reasonable efforts, and those are related to the data that's being protected. The other issue is a firewall and a virus program being installed on your firm's computer and being able to keep track of these things. So some of the things to think about. Our small town lawyer sometimes enjoys taking a break, and he walks from the office down to the Driftless Cafe during the workday with his laptop. While at the cafe, our lawyer uses the free Wi-Fi access to check his client email. Is our lawyer compliant with the rule? Anybody want to take a stab? Yeah, probably not. Free Wi-Fi is not secure at all. You should probably consider using a VPN. That's a virtual private network. It's a very easy software to install. Most tech companies know about this and know how to do this. It's a software that secures and privatizes data across the internet. So it's essentially building an encrypted tunnel throughout the internet where, you know, when you access the internet, your data passes through this tunnel that is protected from CNIs. It's like a private Wi-Fi that encrypts everything, emails, web browsing history, instant messages, voiceover if you're using your computer for a telephone. And another benefit is that if the data is intercepted, your identity is protected, so it masks the IP. I've had our email hacked from using free Wi-Fi at a hotel. I was using my personal computer. We were coming back. My wife had a conference. I can't remember. It was big city, Orlando or San Diego. I can't remember which one. But we had spent the weekend using the internet. And as we got on the plane, we started getting text messages like, "Oh, are you guys okay?" And you know, we're about to leave and depart. So like, what's going on? We land at our connecting flight, and we found out that by using the server, however they did it, I'm not, you know, that tech savvy, but they were able to find our password to our emails and whatever we accessed during that weekend, and they had done the old, "Oh, I'm injured," you know, posted on Facebook, "Oh, we got it, you know, we're stuck, we need some money, please wire money transfers," essentially, as soon as possible. So we started getting private messages. Most people didn't take the bait, but, you know, took over our emails and changed the password, took over our Facebook and changed the password, and we couldn't access them anymore. So we had to, a lot of messy stuff for just using the email, and they had timed it. They had figured out from our emails that we were going to be on a flight, and that's when they decided to take the time to do that. So be careful with free Wi-Fi. The son-in-law, seeing our lawyer's budding enjoyment of technology, decides to give him an iPad for Christmas. The lawyer enjoys it so much that he decides to buy one for the office. The son-in-law helps him set up that iPad so he can use it to review client emails. He forgets the iPad on the cafe bar. Does it violate the rules? I'm trying to elicit the fact that you should probably have your phone with password protected at a bare minimum. You should probably also set it up to erase. I know the Apple one does. If you try a password 10 times and it's not correct, it will wipe the phone. You should probably have some kind of, if you're going to have confidential information or work information on your iPads and other devices, you should think about these things. Two-factor identification, where they send you a text when you try to enter the email or the password. It talks about the rules, again, talk about reasonable measures. So, you know, what's reasonable under the circumstances? Let's see. Sure. I'll just mention it then. Texts, be careful. You have to preserve the documentation. So how do you preserve a text conversation? I've had client text me, hey, are you available? I try to call them, that's fine, but I don't want to have text conversation about substantive issues. You probably should not. It's complicated. I don't really know how to preserve text. I suppose if you do, you know, go ahead, but be careful. There's an ethics decision on the cloud computing. That's formal ethics 1501. Talks about the efforts that should be done if you're going to use a cloud. And in screening a lawyer, we kind of talked about it already. Make sure that you can lock even electronic information from prying eyes. AVO was the last one. I went on trying, just briefly, trying to figure out if it was compliant, and I was left thoroughly confused because it also, you know, it mentions the name of a lawyer, you know, just the expertise briefly. There are some client reviews, they can't be paid, but AVO has its own rating service, and the advertising rule talks about the referral service not being able to recommend you, essentially. So does AVO having a listing, you know, and a rating from 7, it goes from 7 to 10 for most lawyers, it's from 1 to 10 as a scale, does that infer some kind of recommendation when you have a 10 and a 6? Because now, I saw this morning, AVO allows you to have a 15-minute phone conversation for $40. So how is the fee split, and are they recommending you with their own internal private it's their own algorithm. You know, your rating is not dependent on your client reviews. It's rated on all sorts of things that they control and probably what they make money on. So be careful with those technologies.
Thank you so much. This is really keep these guys coming back year after year because you learn something every time. You're a little scared and I think I'm ready to go. January 24th is our next meeting, and it's on bankruptcy procedures related to the IRS and the U.S. Attorney's Office. Yeah. So, Richard Grossman, who's great, and Lisa Young, she's going to be talking to us about other offices, bankruptcy issues. So please come back January 24th. Happy holidays.